going to MidCon and public libraries, and I have seen the various degrees of technology and how things have advanced, in addition to how it has changed our world. And the library of my childhood in the 80s is significantly different than the library of my daughter in 2015. So obviously there are things that anyone could see, but what specifically sticks out to you in terms of technology that we have been able to utilize from when back at the beginning to when you came in to where we came in and where we are today?
You know, the exciting thing about libraries and technology, or probably not the exciting thing, but the thing that most people don't understand or don't know or don't realize, is they think about libraries as a place for books and sort of legacy technology. You know, a book is a form of technology. I mean, you know, written communication was not always in the form of a book, and certainly not a mass market paperback book. And so, I mean, there's arguments that libraries have always sort of been leading edge in terms of technology. But in terms of information delivery systems from, oh gosh, you know, about 1500 until about 1970, information delivery systems were pretty stable and consistent. And so it's only been over the last few years that those paradigms have been shifting. And so people have seen significant changes. But even within that, libraries have been among the leading edge in terms of technology and technology adoption. You know, not even talking about Mid-Continent for a second, but one of the thing, you know, one of the first integrated library systems, that computerized integrated library systems, was developed by Ralph Parker. And Ralph Parker was a PhD at the University of Missouri and one of the founders of the University of Missouri's Library School. And he took IBM Selectrics and IBM computers, punch card-based systems, and built the first circulation control system using that. And this was back like in the late 1940s, early 1950s. Really, really ahead of his time. And Dr. Parker, along with several other people, were the people who were involved in creating the online MARC record format with the Library of Congress. And so the whole idea of using a computer to manage your library collection is something that a lot of people really didn't see happening in their neighborhood library until the middle of the until the latter half of the 20th century. But in the middle of the 20th century, we actually had pioneers in Missouri actually doing this for people. The other another big thing where libraries were sort of on the leading edge of the use of technology is CD-ROMs. I mean, the first time that I actually saw CD-ROMs, well, the first time I saw CD as a media container was for music, which is what everybody saw it as. But the first time that I actually saw CD-ROMs for data was at the University of Missouri when I was working on my library degree, and there were a lot of databases. At this point, it was before the internet was widely acceptable or widely used by people. And what they were doing is they were spinning off databases like Reader's Guide to Periodicals on CDs. And you'd put CDs into a computer and they would, you know, and you'd be able to do a search. And it was still much better than having to search like 10 volumes of the Reader's Guide or the History Index or something like that. You have to do like four different searches on different CD-ROMs because you couldn't run, they didn't have like jukebox CD-ROMs and you had to put in one at a time back then. Most CD-ROMs were only double spin. The fastest ones you could get were 2X. And I remember the state library at that particular time had a WORM drive, which WORM stood for Write Once, Read Many. And basically, it was a burnable CD-ROM drive. And it was the only one in the state. And they used it for a number of different things. And I think, I'm trying to remember what it cost. It cost something like $10,000, $15,000, something ridiculous like that. You know, something now that's almost like a disposable item in terms of, you know, people buying writable CD-ROM burners. And so, I mean, I always like to point that out because libraries in many ways have been on the leading edge of adopting technology. And a lot of people just don't realize it because they haven't seen it in their local library. And Mid-Continent was no different. In the late 1960s, because Mid-Continent was pretty progressive under Jim Leathers, they started looking at ways that they could use technology to be more efficient in the ways that they manage things. And really, there was two ways that early Mid-Continent did that. One was the purchase of an IBM mini computer And they used the IBM mini computer for finance. All of their bookkeeping and finance was done on that. They also kept the patron database on that IBM computer. I think there was a couple of other minor applications for that, but Mid-Continent hired a recent returnee from Vietnam to actually run the IBM computer. He'd done a lot of computer work while he was in Southeast Asia, and his name was Ed Brotherton. And Ed actually came on to run that computer for early Mid-Continent, and Ed stayed with us until he retired. He was the library's he was the library's third business manager. After Tom Lane and Dick Wilding, Ed Brotherton was the next one. And I'm trying to remember when he retired. I think it was around 2006, in that ballpark. So he was with us through most of the early adoption of technology, and a real important person to Mid-Continent. So, you know, Ed was responsible for that and keeping all of our finances and in order through using online systems, which was all pretty new at that time. I mean, this is pre-spreadsheet. And so the other big technology or technological innovation that Mid-Continent used is that Mid-Continent always viewed itself as one library with many different points of access. And so it wasn't that we had a collection in Grandview and a collection in Weston and a collection in Excelsior Springs. We had a collection, and you could access it anywhere. And if the book you wanted was in the library across town, then we would just request that be brought to you. And the way that we did that, you know, most librarians know that as interlibrary loan. Technically, ours is intra-library loan because it's actually within our library system as opposed to going outside our system. But the way we did that was through these Quix teletype machines that were strung together in sort of a hub-and-spoke method. So all of our branches had essentially teletypes in them, and then with these corresponding teletypes in our interlibrary loan department. So you would request an item, and it would go into ILL, and they would go to the shelf list catalog, because we, at this point, we still didn't have our catalog online, but we had a master card catalog. This giant shelf list is what it was called, that was at the headquarters building. And so then they would track down the book and find out where it was, the holdings for the book, and then they would send out another report later in the day. You know, you sent in your request, what you wanted, and then later they sent out what they needed you to send in. And so that's how we did interlibrary loan back then. And being connected through a teletype system was actually really, really innovative for the day. It sounds kind of corny now, but there really wasn't a better way to do it back then. And certainly within a library system, by the time we were doing this, OCLC was up and running. And so people were able to share materials between library systems, but it was still hard to know how to communicate within a library. So the whole idea of Mid-Continent really valuing the idea of resource sharing, It was all predicated on the idea, I think, first of all, that we were a younger library system. I mean, if we'd been around 50 years and then the teletype came into existence, I'm not sure we would have been so easily or readily to adopt it. But we were at that particular time, which made us really very innovative compared to a lot of other libraries in the world. So that was kind of our technology platform for many, many years. And then we started moving into actual automation. And I should point out that Mid-Continent, by the early 1980s, when we started looking at migrating to a digital system and our INLEX system, our first ILS, many libraries throughout the country had already been automated by this point. Kansas City Public, Johnson County, all the libraries around us had already been automated. Daniel Boone Regional Library had already been automated. And part of it was because in the early days, it was easy to do pure circulation control. So just the idea that this person has this item checked out, not having a card catalog that people can search or anything, but just who has what items checked out, and then calculating the fines for them and sending out mailers telling them that they owe money because their books are overdue, and or replacement bills. All of that was doable within the technology of the late 1970s and early 1980s. You could do what they used to call an abbreviated MARC record, which was a very, very bad thing because they wouldn't convert into new systems. But you could do that, save a lot of space. You could create a patron record that was just a few bytes and link these things together. And it worked. It worked really well. But like I said, there was really no public front end to this. It was really just all circulation control. The big industry leader on that was a company called CLSI. And I think they've kind of made a resurgence again. I think you can still find them out. They kind of went away and kind of come back. But a lot of people had these CLSI systems. Mid-Continent never went that way. And I think in part because our finances wasn't going to let us go that way when people really started jumping on the boat. The next generation of ILS systems came along in the early 1980s, and a lot of these were mounted on mini computers and a true hub and spoke and did have a patron side and had other modules, which would also include things like resource sharing, internal resource sharing and acquisitions modules and even finance modules in some cases. The big industry leaders on those initially were DRA and Dynex, and Inlex was actually a company that did a lot of these as well. They were still clunky. They were character cell based systems. So like you had to do a title search, you'd get like a command screen and you'd have to type TI equals in order to do a title search. And so, you know, clunky, but certainly cutting edge for the day. I mean, the idea that you could search across multiple platforms, do a single search and find out that there is this book in Weston. And, you know, I don't just have to guess. I know it's in Weston. I mean, that was huge. That was really, really huge for the day, even though it was kind of clunky. You know, Kansas City Public, Johnson County, they already had a DRA-based system when we actually started looking at automating ourselves. And when we did this, it was a multi-step process. And actually, a lot of people who are in the Mid-Continent leadership were actually hired on at that time to help with the migration from a paper-based system to a digital system. Because if you think about it, I mean, this is really even before optical character scanning. And so, it was around, but back then a good scan was 90% accuracy, which means, think of it in this term. You put a piece of paper down and you scan it. There's 100 characters on it and you have to change 10 of them. I mean, that's not really considered acceptable by today's standards, but that was the best that OCR could do back then. So you couldn't really just take all the cards and scan them because there would be so many errors that it wouldn't be good. So you have to figure out a way how to digitize this. And they did these through retrospective conversion vendors. So basically what you would do is you would send them, what we did is we sent them list of all of our items by ISBN number and Library of Congress card number, and then the holdings codes. And then they would spin off a database based on that. And then we had to go in and we had to check the database to make sure it really pulled the right MARC record. And it was done by, for Mid-Continent, it was done by a company called Utlis, which was the University of Toronto. That's the UT part of it. We got that back and then started matching them up and then started doing the holdings codes so that we could get barcodes. And what we did is we bought barcodes, what they called smart barcodes. There's smart barcodes and dumb barcodes. And smart barcodes, it was actually a barcode, but it had like the title and the author and the call number printed on the bottom. Dumb barcode didn't have any of those things. And, you know, among some of the people that you might recognize that are in the Mid-Continent leadership that were part of that conversion teams, what Ed did, Ed Brotherton, who was, still around, still working on this stuff. What Ed did is he went to the Fort Osage Vaux Technical School and looked for people who were working in their computer programming and data entry tracks, and tried to get them to come in to help us with these projects for summer projects. Some of the people that he found when he did, or two of the people he found were Rolo Aguilera, who's our head of IT now. He was actually part of one of those conversion teams that came in over the summer and worked on all of that stuff. Brian Gash, who is our chief technology officer, he wasn't at the Votech, but he was actually working at Excelsior Springs and knew about the project. And when they started advertising that they were needing more help along these lines, he actually came in and started working along these lines. Alan Chapin, who is our new assistant director or assistant manager of the IT department, Alan came on February 2nd, 1988, as a member of the second shift night crew. The only reason I know that is because Alan and I started on the same day. I also started. I also started on that day. But we were doing shift work. But a couple of months in, they were telling us that they needed people to help them clean up these MARC records from this project. So Alan and I started working on that, and we did a lot of work along those lines. So we were some of the people that were identified and or that identified opportunity and came to work at Mid-Continent through that original automation process. And then it was slow. Oh my gosh. It took us 5 years to actually go in and attach barcodes to all the different items that were in the database. And gosh, there were so many reasons. I mean, well, first of all, keep in mind, it took us, you know, like two summers, I guess, pretty much to create the database that we needed and to clean up the database and get it to where it needed to be. And the entire time during that 2 years, we know that we're migrating. So we're double processing everything. So everything that comes out of catalog has a barcode, but it also has a pocket for cards and all the legacy sort of checkout system that we had. And the decision was made that we didn't want to, well, because Mid-Continent didn't close for anything back then. I mean, we tried to always stay open for weather. If we were carpeting a branch, we would stay open. We almost ran over scores of customers because we were open while we were trying to move these ranges of shelves. And so obviously we wouldn't close for something like barcoding. And so what would happen is, you know, I was barcoding at North Independence, for example, and you'd barcode with a team of people. And what you do is you'd go along the shelf, because these were in shelf list order, and you'd find the book, and the person on the, usually this is the way it would work, is the person who was holding, you'd work in a team of two, the person holding the sheets with the smart barcodes would read off the basics. You'd match it up with the book as best as you could. And then once you matched it up, you put one on the back, put one on the Verso, and you put one on the card. That's right. You put one on the old Gaylord card. And then you'd move to the next one. And then, of course, the next one after that would be checked out. So you'd have to leave it on the sheet. And then someday you would have to marry those back up again, right? Then you get to the next section, and there'd be somebody browsing. And so you couldn't do anything. And you just had to sit and wait until the person left. And, of course, you know they're going to take half the books that are on your sheet. And so you just knew that that was going to be less productive, which is one of the reasons. And then, of course, you would run across books, too, that didn't match up, or because the call number was so long, you really couldn't be certain that the smart barcode in question was the one matched up with the actual book. And so you'd have to try to look it up on the database or call into IT and have them look it up so that they could give you more information so you'd know which one it was supposed to actually be. So it took 5 years. It took 5 years for us to get through that entire process. The other reason that it took 5 years is because we were sort of pushing the edge of the technology of what NLEX could do. They really hadn't been involved with a library system that was as spread out as ours. And so the idea of pulling stuff in was problematic. We also really wanted to put power to the people. We wanted to put, you know, a lot of public access catalogs out for people to use. And they kept selling us these terminals, and the terminals, they kept frying the chips on the terminals. And so those were made by a company called Zentech. Do not ask me how I remember that level of detail. But So we kept working on trying to get the right Zentech terminals so that they wouldn't fry the chip. And then we could do like a couple of branches at a time. And then we get another bad batch, and we had to kind of put it on hold. So what would happen is, like, Antioch and North Independence would have automated circulating systems, but no one else would. And so someone would be barcoded and someone wouldn't. And if a book came in that wasn't barcoded, you had to check it out the old way on the Gaylord machines. And then for the longest time, AV wasn't cataloged. It took us a long time to bring AV on. So initially, the whole idea is that this would just be a book thing, and the AV stuff would still be physical cha-chunk machine, you know. The other thing that was interesting during that time period was what was known as the Central Reserve, the CR list. And this was printed out on a green and white computer paper, a line printer. And the CR list every morning would basically tell you the books that were on reserve. And so when somebody returned a book, what you'd have to do is you'd have to look at that and see, you know, this book was on hold for someone else. And if it was, then you had to send it in. If it wasn't. So it really did slow down the receiving of items a lot, because you'd check it in, but then you always had to check the list. And of course, some of them you knew. I mean, you know, some of the books that were extremely popular at the time, you know they're on the CR list, so you just check it in and you put it in the box and send it off to ILL so that they can fill the hold. But fortunately for us, and to avoid confusion, we stopped using the CR list right about the time that Colburn Road opened. So we were so CR was open for us to use that abbreviation. So lucked out there. But that was the INLEX system, and INLEX was it was a good system for us. It really did get us up and going. It certainly completely digitized our system, which was really, really good. The other thing is that it started giving us possibilities to do things like see that our customers were willing to use our library if not within the library itself. So one of the things we did is that we bought terminal emulation software for the INLEX, for the HP mini computer that it actually was on. Again, this is sort of pre-internet, pre-World Wide Web. And so, people who had modems, they could buy this software from us for $1, and it's on a floppy disk. And what it would do is it would emulate an HP terminal. And then from that, you'd be able to dial in and you'd be able to use the Mid-Continent catalog from your home. You know, all pretty pedestrian now, but man, that was like Buck Rogers back then. It was high end back then. And then when we started letting customers place their own holds, which I think that was for Blue Spring South, I don't think we went live across the board, but for Blue Spring South, that was in 92. And the reason I remember that is because we actually went live with patrons placing holds when I was on my honeymoon. So I was all freaked out that, you know, how is this going to work when I wasn't around? So when we had the terminal emulation software, people could sit at home and they could place holds.
I can remember having to walk up to the desk and tell the person at the desk as a kid, I want these books. Can you put them on hold? And then they would do it.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to do it for yourself, it's like Christmas morning.
Yeah, and it was a real eye-opener for me because what it taught me is that there are two very distinct types of library users. Up until then, I really didn't make this distinction myself, but there are people who are not only willing, they want to serve themselves, that they actually see that as better service than mediated service. And then there are some people who view mediated service as the best way to provide service. Both are right. And that the real key is that you have to do both for people. And that's been really central to the development of the customer-centered transaction model that we're adopting now. But a lot of the groundwork for that really came, or at least my epiphany around that really came as early as the early 1990s, when we started seeing this with the terminal emulation software and how quickly people moved to being able to, how they wanted to be able to log on for themselves and manage their holds themselves. And, you know, there was still a very loud and vocal group that wanted nothing to do with that. And that was a matter of, you know, managing those expectations. So the other thing that happened for Mid-Continent right about this time, by this time, the internet's beginning to get more robust. I mean, I'd actually seen the internet when I was at college. I mean, you still had to more or less be at some sort of college or university to see the internet back in the early 90s. I had a CompuServe account information service provider. And one of the reasons I had a CompuServe account was because CompuServe could actually get to the real internet. And you could actually get to the internet through CompuServe. And since I'd seen the internet and I knew about gophers and, you know, Archie and Veronica and all, look it up, you'll understand. But I knew about all those things from college. And so I actually uploaded, and it was ridiculous. It was like $12 an hour or something like that. Wow. to be on the internet. I mean, and you could go on to regular CompuServe and you could do other things and it didn't cost anything, but it was like $12 an hour to be on the internet. So you were really very judicious about how you used the internet. But I really got bit by the bug. I mean, the information bug at this. And this was just all personal for me. I mean, I just really liked doing this stuff and doing searches and formulating online searches and stuff like this. And I had a subscription to Internet World Magazine, I think is what it was called back then. There was a four-page tutorial on how to code in HTML. And it taught you just like four or five basic coding heuristics and some basic stuff. And just for fun one night, I decided, well, I'm going to hammer out a branch page. And so I hammered out a Blue Springs branch page, and, you know, put it up in a web browser. By then there were web browsers. And I looked at it, and I'm like, this isn't too bad. And so then I decided I was going to show it to Mr. Ferguson and show it, show him that this was something that was out there, something that was available, and something that we might think about doing one day. And so I was showing it to him, and short time afterwards, I found out that they were creating a new position that they were going to call automation specialist that was going to be responsible for putting Mid-Continent on the internet and everything that involved, and they were offering the job to me, which I felt was very fortunate.
I'm glad you went to his office
that day. I'm glad I went to his office that day. That's the way we kind of did things back then. I mean, I think that if somebody did something similar to me today, I would be equally impressed, but I still think I'd go through a traditional hiring process. One of the first things I got to do was figure out how to get Mid-Continent on the internet. So I found some internet service providers and started working on that. And I started hammering out the other web pages that I'd need to do in order to create a Mid-Continent Public Library website. I started the automation specialist job in July of 95. And before the end of the year, I had a working web page, working website that I still didn't have our presence up on the internet yet. And so we hosted it on Skynet, which was an old internet service provider in Kansas City. So Mid-Continent Public Library was up. It was up and running, and it was, I think its URL was www.sky.net/tildemcpl, I think was our URL.
And easy to remember that one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so we were up and running, and I think, I know we were the first library in Greater Kansas City to have a web presence, which was a big deal because we were the last library to do everything in terms of automation. But we were the first one to have a web presence. And then, and I think we may have been the first one to have a web presence in the state as well. The thing that was, other people were on the internet, but they were on the internet using Gopher Space and things like that. COIN, the Columbia Online Information Network, which was run through Daniel Boone Regional Library, was public access to the internet through a graphical version of the internet. And so, they beat us by many years. We didn't start deploying the internet until 1998, I think. But when we deployed it as a graphical version, much more along the lines of what people are used to seeing today.
I can remember going to Blue Ridge and using INLEX. Is that what it's called?
INLEX was the old
press
system.
Press F1 to search. Right, right. F2 right. To search by title. F1.
Agreed.
Yeah, right. And I can remember right. Being a clerk at Blue Ridge and using green screen software and
right.
Big date due stickers and the date due buttons going down on the books. At some point, 2003 or 2004, Mid-Continent made a decision to change to a system that every public library I've visited since seems to have. So I thought this was some revolutionary thing that we were doing. But now that I see it being used at Johnson County and other systems, so take us through the idea of converting to CIRCE and having receipts instead of date due stickers and all of that.
Well, certainly one of the biggest pet peeves of almost all of our library customers from day one was the date due stickers. That people hated the date due stickers. A handful of people liked them, but like 90% of the people hated them. And it's because, they'd gum up the back of the books. Some people thought we were ruining the back of the books. I mean, there were all kinds of different reasons as to why. But, it was not a bad solution for the day. But as is true with a lot of our technology decisions, real early on, they were really innovative. By the end of life, they were kind of clunky. And that's definitely where we got to with the date due guns. And so the impetus to change ILS was not around the date due stickers. It was actually around a couple of other things. One thing is that INLEX, while it was very innovative and very forward thinking, when we signed on in 83 or so, they'd stopped working. They'd really stopped working on the system. They hadn't done, by the time we started looking for something else, they hadn't done a software upgrade to their system in 10 years. And this actually did a couple of really, really bad things for us. I mean, one thing that it did is it helped create a culture where our staff believed that technology could be so stable that it would never have an update. And so, so jumping forward just a little bit, the first couple of times that we had an update on Circe, people kept saying, when is it just going to stop being updated? When can we get back to when it was like it was before? And, you know, that was
like
that,
Facebook. Everybody complains when Facebook updates.
And it was kind of like that. I mean,
and it becomes the norm.
Well, and the big problem with us is that because we had never really been used to those updates, what we're used to is doing workarounds. And so if we found something that was a problem, we would work around. We wouldn't report it. We'd just work around it and never expect it to get fixed. Right. Because that's the way our ILS worked. And so so we got to a point where INLEX was being bought by DRA. And DRA is a big, surprisingly, St. Louis company, but they didn't have their first St. Louis customer until they almost went out of business. It just weird the way it ended up working. And part of it was the CEO who was involved at the time. He was the type of guy that you either hated him or you mildly disliked him, but I don't know anybody who really liked him. I mean, you know, he's just real abrasive personality. And so it didn't work out real well in terms of selling to at least to Midwesterners. And so anyway, DRA buys INLEX as INLEX is, you know, clearly not doing anything except, you know, cashing people's checks. And so what happened is Johnson County and Kansas City Public were actually on a shared DRA system. Mid-Continent and Kansas City, Kansas were both on INLEX systems. And so DRA was supporting both platforms, INLEX and DRA. Everyone in Greater Kansas City essentially was owned by the same vendor at that particular time. And then shortly after that, DRA is bought. Well, they make the announcement that they're going to stop supporting the INLEX system. And then DRA was bought by Circe. And then later Circe is bought by Dynex, which is why it's called Circe Dynex. But so we were looking at the system and we realized that INLEX was no longer going to be used. The character cell version of INLEX was no longer going to be around, and that we would have to migrate to the INLEX, to the Circe system. And many of us really got to thinking about this and said, you know, the migration from INLEX to Circe is just as big a jump as if we were going to go from INLEX to Triple I with innovative interfaces, or INLEX to any other ILS. And so what we did is we said, okay, we're going to treat this as an opportunity to really go out to market and figure out what we want and what's the best option for us, not necessarily just automatically migrate to Circe just because they now own our business because they bought our business as part of DRA. And so we did. We went and we looked at looked at Dynex, which was a standalone company at the time. We looked at III and we looked at Circe. And one of the parts of this involved a bus trip, which was kind of interesting. We all got on a bus. We went down to Springfield Green to take a look at III. They're still on III. We also got on a bus and we went to Indianapolis, Marion County. I think they were running Dynex at the time, I think. And then we went to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and we looked at them. They were running one of the versions of it. And we looked at all of these sort of in a working environment. And what we determined at the time was that actually Circe Dynex made the most sense for us. It was the most robust system that was out there. It's searching. Which this may surprise people because I know there are problems, you know, with expectations around searching, but the searching was actually much better than the other people that we were involved with. And they were really good at managing interlibrary loan or resource sharing, which of course is still really important and one of the first things that we did in terms of technology. So we decided to migrate the whole system to Circe. And at that point, we brought in everybody, we retrained them, we took advantage to do some new things that we'd always wanted to do, but never could do, including doing away with the date due sticker guns. We went to a receipt printer system, which has been equally liked and disliked. Some people still don't like it. But I think a lot of people have do like it better than the old sticker guns. And then shortly after we got migrated to Cersei. Cersei was bought by Dynex, and now it is Cersei Dynex. So we basically have migrated all the way through. But the real advantage to where we are now is that we're with a company that is innovating, and that they're staying up to date with their updates, and that's a very, very good thing for us. That certainly is not where we were with NLEX. With NLEX, not only was it an old system, but it was an old system that wasn't being maintained. And so that was very bad. So I think what ended up happening is we have a far superior system in terms of people being able to manage their own accounts, and being able to see the collection. But there's still a few things we'd like it to be able to do better. I mean, in all honesty, I was talking with one of the vice presidents at Cengage, Gale, not too long ago about this. And one of the things that he was asking me about was what was my greatest frustration. Actually, Nate Hill, formerly from Chattanooga, Tennessee, public library, was there. And we both almost in unison said the ILS. I mean, because compared to what consumers are used to, it's so clunky. And part of the reason why, I think, is because it builds on top of legacy, on top of. And what someone really needs to do is just start from square one and rewrite all the code from square one, and to give a whole lot less options. I mean, that basically what they need is something kind of like Apple. I mean, you know, where the Apple platform really gives you a whole lot less options. I mean, for a guy like me, that's not as much fun. But the truth of the matter is it runs a lot better because people aren't trying to do 75 different things with
it. Sorting by publisher. Right.
Or even worse, sorting by Library of Congress catalog number. Why on earth would, I mean, other than a cataloger, why on earth would you want to do that? And so why not get the catalogers in the world to do it a different way, as opposed to handicapping, you know, our millions of library customers?
So that's a good segue, because libraries in general, but especially Mid-Continent, we have what's called the virtual branch now, where it's its own entity, the e-content, the databases, and that's something we push so much to our customers, and they are flabbergasted when we tell them all of these newspapers and magazines and databases and test prep that you can do, all because it's, if you have a valid library card, access pass, and it's all free as long as it's, you put in your number. So, and this is something I know that we have all talked about internally, when there's terrible weather, it's easier to make that decision now, knowing that our customers will have access to that information from home.
Right.
So where do you see that going in terms of, or how far has that come for you personally from back in the days of the Gaylord machine and Day Do stickers?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, one of my favorite stories, I've got a whole stack of stories of, you know, things they didn't teach you in library school or things they didn't warn you about in library school. And one of my favorites involves me standing out in the middle of 7 Highway shoveling the turn lane in on 7 Highway with a hand shovel. And part of the reason why, We were in the middle of a blizzard. I mean, we had like, you know, about a foot of snow on the ground. People couldn't catch up, but we were still open. Mid-Continent Public Library was still open, and we were not allowed to close. And so everybody who came to visit the Blue Springs branch from the north, if they were coming from the north on 7 Highway, they would get to the turn lane. Now, the way I got to work is I went up to the nearest cross street, did a U-turn so that I didn't turn across, you know, the 12 inches or 18 inches of snow that was in the middle of the median. But everybody else tried to plow through that median. And as soon as I got plowing through that median, they'd get stuck. And so after I dug out 2 cars, because no one was really coming. I mean, all the cars I was digging out were staff that were coming in. No one was actually coming to the library, right? Yeah. And so after I dug out a couple of my staff, I was actually standing out there in the middle of the road, shoveling out 7 Highway, trying to make some sort of a throughway so people could make, but you know, I successfully did it. But again, something I never would have thought that I would have been doing when I went away to library school. But the point was, back then our administration was extremely hesitant to close. And part of the rationale was, imagine if you had driven down 7 Highway, you're extremely conscientious, and for whatever reason, you You'd gotten the car, you'd driven down 7 Highway, you'd somehow made it across the 18 inches of snow, got into our driveway to return your books, and it's close. Because we didn't have book drops back then. And so I think, frankly, I think what happened, we tended to respond to the squeaky wheel too a lot back then. And it wouldn't have surprised me if, you know, one day we closed, somebody complained, and then that was it. And, you know, short of snow being above the doors, we were not going to close. And yeah, as I said before, we didn't close. When we carpeted branches, we didn't close. None of that, we wouldn't close. And so so two things happened. The first thing that happened was the installation of the book drops. And the installation of the book drops solved a lot of that issue, where if we're closed, people can put the items in the book drop. And yeah, they're disappointed because they can't get into the library. But as long as it's strategically closed, we're in good shape. Which, you know, that's what we did for RFID. You know, we'd close North Independence, but not South Independence. We closed Lee Summit, but not Colburn Road, and then flipped it the next week or the week after. So strategic closings made sense as we, you know, started doing carpeting and things like that. And then the next thing was the digital library and the online content. I mean, for me, access is extremely important. And the idea that people can access information, whether they are in the building or in their home, is part of what's going to make us extremely relevant going into the 21st century. Part of our focus around small business, every startup small business person that I know, or startup or small business person, I guess I should say. I mean, unless you're getting to the point that you've got a pretty huge staff, you know, you're still doing your marketing plan at 3 a.m. I mean, you know, you're just cramming in whatever you can do. And so it makes sense that we have things like Reference USA or Demographics Now or, these business resources that are available 24/7. It just makes perfect sense because those folks aren't, I mean, they can't come to us during business hours because that's when they've got their businesses open, and they can't come to us, you know, during other times. So why not just make it available all the time? And so that became an important criteria when we started licensing databases back in the late 90s, is we want the two things. One thing we wanted to do is, if possible, we wanted to own content. And so a lot of our content we actually own outright. And all we do is pay like $100 a year access fee to it. And that's one of the reasons why we have so many databases, because we actually own it. If we were actually paying for access, I don't know that we would have as many. But at this point, it's actually relatively cheap to have some of the databases that we have. The other thing that we decided was remote access. If we couldn't get remote access, unless it was a real extenuating circumstance, we just wouldn't get it. And lots of times we used that and we played hardball with that. I mean, and what would end up happening is we would get remote access out of it. They'd come back and after a year, they'd say, okay, we figured out how to IP authenticate. Can we now sell to you? And it's like, yes, we will now buy. And so so that was a huge thing for us. And it gets to this notion that I was talking about, or that I often talk about, that the library is no longer a building, that the library are a place, but the library is a place and a service. And you have to have as robust a service remotely as you do as robust a place when people go to visit it. And that really did start to come true as we started looking at times when the libraries closed unexpectedly. When the libraries closed expectedly, like, you know, New Year's Day or Christmas Day or something like that, people make accommodations and they figure out their patterns. But when the libraries closed unexpectedly, what happens? You know, the fear way back when was that there'd be all these people trying to get to the library and the library wouldn't be open and people would get mad. What we've discovered, we didn't have a snow day this year because it just wasn't, you know, fortunately we had really nice weather. But last year we had a couple snow days, and we did about a third of the business on the snow day as what we would have done if we would have been open normally, in terms of circulation, in terms of holds placed, in terms of downloads, database uses, the things that we could capture, we did about a third of our normal business, and we didn't even open the doors. To me, that number is going to grow, especially as we get better quality content, as we're able to work with people around licensing arrangements for feature films and for more music. I think what we'll find is that there's going to be more opportunities to do this sort of thing. And it wouldn't surprise me at all that we would have a snow day at some point and we do like 80 or 90% of our normal circulation. That'll easily happen, I think, sometime before I retire.
Yeah.
Yeah, telling people about our online services like ebooks and magazines and all that stuff, and telling them that they can do that from home. So if they don't have the time to come to a branch, they can still get plenty of materials.
Right.
And it's seeing their reaction is always just amazing.
The story that I, the one that I always like to relate to people is when I was in Scotland. And actually, I wasn't in Scotland. I was in England, but I was getting ready to go to Scotland. And, you know, being a good librarian, a good book person, I thought I should have a travel guide with me, you know, just in case, because I'll have maps and things like that, and it'll be handy. And so I'm sitting in my hotel room, and I'm like, gosh, I don't really want to buy a travel guide, and I don't want to drag a travel guide around with me. And then I realized, wait a minute, we've got all these travel guides through Overdrive, right? And so I log on to Overdrive. I'm in my hotel room in Manchester. I log into Midcontinent. I download a travel guide. It comes onto my iPad. I've got it downloaded and I've got it checked out, and I've got my Scotland travel guide. And you know, I'm about as far away as I can be and still be able to do that. I've got a friend who's a missionary right now, and he does homeschooling. He did homeschooling before he left, and he's on mission in India. Before he left, he bought an out of district access pass, and his whole deal was, you know, he wants to be able to have, you know, language skills and language training for his kids. He wants to be able to have the types of good resources that he knows he's not going to be able to get in India. I mean, he knows that he could get internet, surprisingly. I mean, they actually have pretty good internet over there, but he knew he wouldn't be able to get good resources. And so he bought an out-of-district access pass. His mother comes in every year, pays us the money to renew it, and he keeps it going every year. And so he's halfway around the world, but using our resources. And I think completely legitimately. I mean, when he's not on a mission trip, he lives in Blue Springs. And so, I mean, it makes perfect sense that he should be able to use that. And he's paying his way. He gets his official mailing addresses in Blue Springs. So, and his kids are not falling behind, because in a way they could fall behind, you know, through their father taking on this mission, but they're not, and we're able to help with that.
So the big thing that Midcontinent has, technology wise and then materials wise in the last year, has been RFID conversion, which any customer who has been in a Midcontinent branch in the last maybe 6 months, I'm not sure when the last branch was completed, has seen a new way of checking out items that is different than before. And can you explain what RFID is quickly? Most people hopefully know that by now, but why we made this conversion and how it's helpful and how it sets us up for the future.
Well, I think this is another situation. RFID is radio frequency identification, and it's a new form of inventory control. But it's another thing that when you really take it out of the library context and just look at who else is using RFID right now, while it's out there and, you know, not a foreign concept, it's not used in broad ways right now or in large ways. In fact, you know, in terms of inventory and theft control, you'll find merchandise people, you know, Walmart, Target, places like that, they're still using magnetic systems. I mean, the gates that they have are magnetic. They're not RFID. A lot of credit card companies are starting to talk about using RFID, using the chip and PIN system to increase security. But and a lot of them have made the changes to their terminals, but you haven't really seen a broad adoption of this. So I think this is another situation where, once again, we may be not ahead of the curve, but certainly toward the front edge of the curve in terms of the larger marketplace. RFID has been, in terms of inventory control, has been something libraries have been looking at for about 10 years now. And I've been going to library conferences, and people have been talking about RFID for all of that time. And certainly if you go back to around 2006, 2007, that's the last time RFID was sort of gaining momentum. And a lot of people were starting to sign up to convert their systems to RFID. But back then, the tags for RFID cost about $1 a piece, like just the plain Jane tags, not the ones for like the clear ones that we used for picture books or the ones that we used for audiovisual. Those were much more, $3 a piece or something like that. And so, you know, as you started looking at the return on investment, it made no sense. It made absolutely no sense. We had about 3.5 million items. It made no sense to spend $3.5 million just on the tags, not on the labor, not on the hardware, just on the tags. And so I just kept watching this and then determining, okay, once we get to a certain point, once the tags start getting down around a quarter a piece, then it'll be time for us to go. And so, so the bigger question might be, so why do it? I mean, if it's just inventory control and barcodes manage inventory just fine, why would we do it? And the thing is that I started to discover that it's more than just inventory control. It can do a whole lot more. So for example, an RFID tag, although we're not doing this now, one of the things that you can do is that when you loan a book to another library system, libraries always put a whole bunch of paperwork with that book when they loan it to another system. You could actually write all of that information onto the RFID tag in a temporary way. So that way you don't have the paperwork, you don't lose the paperwork, and people can still get it back. Another thing that I saw that was particularly useful in terms of RFID was not just the ability to check out, which is, you know, 1,000 times easier in an RFID system. You don't have to line up the barcode and get everything just right. You can just take 5 of them and put them in the little box and it checks out all 5. It doesn't matter what direction they are. I mean, it's a lot more customer friendly. But it's not just check out, it's check in. So that if people want to manage their accounts, and this was a part I didn't really see until I saw it in action, that if people want to take their books and check them in and then manage their accounts right there, they can do that. That's not something, I mean, it's something that everyone expected. When we first put out our Kingsley book drops, people would put their books in the book drop. Then they'd come up to the service desk and they would say, I just returned all my books out there. Yeah. What's my fine? And it's like, you know, not realizing that it wasn't at all attached. Now, for those people, if they could actually have a system where they could be checking in their items and managing it, they would love that. And that's what we've seen. We've seen that, you know, it's not for everyone, but a lot of people are managing their own accounts, managing their own check-ins by doing this. And as the software gets more robust and as we're able to do other things, I think more people will be able to take that on and it'll be positive for them. Another reason, and this is the way I told the board, or one of the reasons I told the board that we should do this, is that it's not exciting and it's a lot like plumbing. It's a lot like a utility. I mean, everybody needs it, but no one really wants to talk about it. And no one wants to pay for it. And the thing is that, you know, if you've got plumbing running to your house, if you've got running water and, you know, running to and from your house, you can do a lot of things with that running water, but you don't necessarily think about it when you initially put it in. It's the same thing here, that there's going to be lots of opportunities coming on the horizon around what you can do with an RFID tag. I don't know what all of those are, but I do know that you have to have that infrastructure in place in order for that to occur. So because we had a surplus that had built over several years and it was undesignated and there wasn't a designated purpose for it, I asked the board about it, and we asked the board about doing several different projects, and this is one that they kind of agreed. I mean, if we were to ever go to the public and try to fundraise for RFID, you know, they'd laugh us out of the building. I mean, it would not be successful. So this would be something that we could do and could potentially move us forward. And I think that there's lots of advantages. I mean, some of the things we've discovered in terms of inventory control and theft remediation. I'm not going to say theft prevention, because we never really installed it to prevent people from stealing stuff. Because frankly, all things being equal, as large as our system is and everything, we don't have a big theft problem. I mean, we have an annoying theft problem. The thing that you always want is lots of times stolen. But in general, it wasn't that big a deal. But what we've discovered since we've installed the RFID, you know, people who do steal things, the gates go off. Lots of times people will stop and say, oh, I didn't know. They knew, but, you know, we can kind of get that controlled. But some people will just run through the gate. The gate will go off. They'll keep running. This happens at a couple of branches where we've got incident reports on this. But the good news is we know what they took. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now because we know what they took, we can look and see, was that on hold for someone? If it was on hold for someone, we can place a new hold. If it wasn't on hold for someone, but we know it's popular, we could order a replacement copy. It allows us to manage the collection in a more proactive way, as opposed to later discovering that it's missing.
More instant than when you're doing inventory and all these 500 items are missing now, right. And we've just figured this out.
Yeah.
It's more an instant notification.
Exactly. I'll tell you one sort of Buck Rogers in the future thing that RFID allows us to do is I've been looking with a company that they've developed a solution that they've installed in Scandinavian countries. It hasn't been installed over here, but it's been installed like 50 times in various Scandinavian countries. And what it allows you to do is to using an RFID-based collection with gates and then installing some additional like IP-based cameras and then installing a card reader on the front of your building, what it allows you to do is extend your hours with no staff. So the idea here would be, say, for example, we decide that we want to have our standard hours. You know, we want to be open our normal hours like we normally are, but we want to sort of have extra time, you know, kind of like in soccer. You want to have extra time from 9 o'clock to 10:30 for people to be able to finish up any homework or whatever. We could actually set up a system like this that would allow people into the library. They could use the resources, kind of record them. You know, people started, you know, acting up. We would know they'd be on camera and there'd be tapes and all of that. And if they want to check stuff out, they could check stuff out. If they didn't check stuff out, it wouldn't let them out the door, you know, things like that. And a system like that's only going to work with an RFID system. Now, I'm not talking at all about people-less libraries. I mean, what I'm talking about doing is extending our time. So, you know, a lot of our two-star branches, for example, aren't open every night. This would be a way that they could be open every night without having any additional costs. So,
yeah, we've had people kind of share concerns about, like you talked about, people-less libraries, so that it's kind of all automated and everything.
Does this mean they're getting rid of you guys? So we've been replaced by this kiosk?
You know, we're still there to help them through that process, but now we have more time and more space, I suppose, to kind of take care of some other duties that we have.
Right.
Materials handling is going to go down, so we can do more people things and helping others and taking visits at places and being out in the community more is the way I look at it.
We're still there to interact with them. We're not.
Yeah. Right. And it's both. It's like I said before, when I discovered that there was a group of people who wanted their holds to be mediated and other people who didn't want their holds to be mediated, I still expect it to be both. I mean, I expect when somebody comes to the service counter and says, I want to check these books out, and you go, well, you know, do you want to try this machine? They say, no. I expect the books to be checked out at the service counter. It's, you know, for some people they're going to want to, and some people they're not going to want to. But I think the big thing that it gives us is the ability to have meaningful relationships with our customers that's not over the desk. Because now this is one thing going way back. This is one of the things that I used to have an issue with, is that I'd be checking out books, you know, sometimes with the cha-chunk and sometimes with the barcode wand, and there'd be a line of four people deep and there'd be someone wanting to talk to me, and I was the only person on the desk. And how do you kick that person out so that you can keep the process going? All the while behind, the people are getting more and more frustrated because they can't get the service that they need. And so what a system like we have in place allows is to do both. And you can have a conversation with somebody who wants to have the conversation with you, but for the people who just want to get in and get out, they can do that too. And the other thing that I've talked to several branches about this, and it's the idea that you don't, I've searched, I've looked in our policies, I've looked in our procedures, I've read the library literature. Nowhere does it say the only place you can have a conversation with a customer is across the service counter. You can have that conversation anywhere. It could be in the stacks. It could be, in fact, if you were walking by and you were starting to have a nice conversation with somebody and they were sitting on a couch, I'd encourage you to sit down next to them on the couch. It's a much more friendly position than standing over them.
The desk with the equipment and everything kind of in between you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's a much better way to build a stronger relationship. But again, this is a change. Now, when I was a branch manager, you know, we were forbidden from setting in the furniture that just didn't look right. What I'm saying is that's exactly what we need to be if we want to be part of a larger community. Certainly, you can go through all the inventory numbers and all of that. And our headcount is down. I mean, at one point, Mid-Continent had about 1,000 employees. Now we have about 950 employees. But none of that was a result of laying people off relative to RFID or any of those other self-service initiatives.